In this episode of The Ownership Economy, Jahed and I connect with Golda Velez, the co-founder of What's Cooking, an activity planning startup working to strengthen communities, create opportunities, and democratize corporations. Golda comes from a background working as a senior software engineer in some of the largest Web2 digital platforms. She worked on data at Uber, risk at Postmates, and held a variety of other roles leading teams and building complex, scalable platforms. She is now taking that experience and applying it to building a stakeholder-owned and governed platform for community engagement. We dig into the business model, how she started, tools she's using for ownership and governance, and other aspects of team building in this early stage venture. For engineers interested in transitioning from Web2 to Web3, we also recommend episode 5 with Kevin Owocki from Gitcoin and episode 8 with James Young from Abridged. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Thanks for joining us today, Golda.
Yeah, thank you, Jahed. I really appreciate it.
So we like to start this usually by just getting an understanding of you as a person. So could you tell us a bit about yourself? Where does your story start? And how did you enter the sort of larger crypto space?
Yeah, well, I'll try to keep it short, which I may fail at. I was an applied math major, knew I was going to work in computers, started in a developmental biology lab doing sea urchin DNA analysis. But yeah, we're not going to go through all the intervening bits. I've done some risk. I've done a lot of messy data. And kind of entered the Web3 space because I knew it would be important for human rights stuff because I was involved with some of the not only disinformation attacks, but what people get wrong is that it's a matter of pushing misinformation against victims of violence. And so I was really aware of that. So when the Twitter Blue Sky thing came out and I saw that, I was like, wow, I really want to be involved in this because I understand how important Twitter is. And wound up getting myself talked into that original group, was there when Jack introduced the Twitter Blue Sky thing and got to meet a lot of really cool people in the space, which I understood as people, a lot of those people are the people in really cool tech who also care deeply about human rights, are in kind of a decentralized space. And so when I next was switching jobs, which was when Uber bought Postmates, I was lucky enough to enter that space a little bit more. But at the same time, I've been doing a startup that involves changing the nature of corporations and also attacking disinformation. So we're kind of an ambitious little startup.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I think like it sounds like some of those past experiences then fed into what you're doing here. In addition to you had some personal values that you saw an opportunity to sort of bring into fruition in this Web3 space. Is that about right?
Yeah. It's stuff I've been thinking about for a very long time. I remember being a kid thinking, wow, we're in a democracy, yet my school is definitely not a democracy. And most jobs.
Yes, you and children everywhere. And honestly, I'm so glad you said that because like I can tell a lot by people when they make that comment about like the fate of children and democracy in schools, if they get that point or they don't. So like that's exactly right. 100% agree.
I mean, not that my school was bad or anything. It's just, you know, went a little agency here.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think, and I can expand on that. Like, I can just keep talking anytime you want me to.
Please continue.
So I think, okay, so I'm Jewish and I grew up reading kind of about, you know, the Holocaust and stuff like that. And my main takeaway from it is like, wow, you know, the people standing around should have done something. And then all of a sudden I'm an adult and I start reading stories. I'm like, wow, I'm one of the people standing around. And because there's stuff going on where people are getting hurt and you're not only, you know, indirectly benefiting, sometimes you're directly benefiting, depending on where your laptop was made, depending on who's on the board and who's the investors of the startup you just got a big bunch of money from, you know, trace some of that stuff down. It's not that indirect. And so I would take advantage of that. For example, you know, during the time I worked at Uber, one of the members of our board of directors is also one of the head guys in Saudi who was, you know, friends with MBS. And so when I am trying to advocate for a guy kidnapped in Saudi, I would use our internal messaging system and bug our CEO. It's like, hey, Derek, can awesome. You talk to Yasser about this dude? Because he's in prison and I think Yasser could get him out and he's getting beat up and you know, his family's upset. So, you know, you have to use those connections. You're a member of the world. You know, when you read stuff in the news, you're like, oh, man, that's too bad. I guess I got to get back to work now. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. If you have 30 minutes and you had 30 minutes and your server was down, would you be like, oh, man, that's too bad. I guess I got to go read the news now. You know, you wouldn't do that. You would take your 30 minutes and try to get your server back up. You would do something in 30 minutes and you can do something in 30 minutes about whatever is important. And that's kind of where I was coming from with the human rights work. And so that's what we would do. And I could riff on that all day. I mean, yesterday morning, I was, you know, one of the people I went to work with, my human rights group, is in Syria, and his kid is sick with cholera. The water is really dirty in northern Syria. We had 30 minutes. And so we were like, you know, we found a lady who worked on the latest NIH grant in Bangladesh and called her because she's at the University of Maryland. We just called her on the phone and got her in line at the bank. And we're like, hey, we need a grant to get filtration systems into Syria. She said she'd call me back. So hopefully she still will. Otherwise, I'm going to call her again today, you know, when I have a minute break. But I mean, the thing is, if you have 30 minutes, you can do something. We're engineers. You know, we solve problems. We don't just sit there, you know, observing them. Anyway, so.
No, I love that you're riffing. This is like me being should be the more impartial podcast host, but I basically love everything you just said. I like to dig in a bit more into the stuff you're talking about with Uber and Postmates, because we are really interested here on the pod on changing paradigms around work culture, forms of organization. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what was it like to build and ship software at Uber and Postmates?
Well, so I got a job at Postmates in the risk team, which was fighting bad actors, which was super fun. I absolutely loved my team, loved everybody. And I mean, it's just fun because it's like you're in a live video game fighting against another organized team that's constantly combating you, and you're training your models and they're like training their models, and like they're trying to trick your models, and you're like, ha, I see what you guys are doing. You just wait till those things wake up. So, I mean, it's really fun, and I love fighting bad actors. We were actually, most of it was organized stuff that happened to be coming out of China that we called the WeChat fraud ring. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting. I mean, there's a lot of different sources of fraud. That was just one particular source that was an organized ring. And then Uber bought Postmates, and I am very thankful that I got those stock options and was able to put them into my company. And you know how many people you can support in Myanmar for those Uber stock options? Because that was, you can actually amazing. Do a lot with these options. I didn't give them all to that. I gave some of them to now the colleges are wondering where that money is because they want it because my kids are in college. but that's another story.
Don't worry. We're not going to tell the colleges or your children about it.
Yeah, I already told them. It's like, sorry, guys. Anyway, I don't think that's actually a good parenting technique. But back to that. So with Uber, you know, I mean, they're great engineers. I mean, super skilled teams. You know, I don't know if people go to work at Uber because they want to change the world, though. You know, people do go to work in the decentralized web because they want to change the world. Some of the Web3 people would like to own the world, and some of them would like to help other people own the world. So there's a whole range of people in Web3, but they do absolutely. Want the world to change.
Yeah, absolutely. And it remains to be seen if that change is going to be good, or if they even wanted to change in good ways. Like you said, the ownership paradigms, it may just be changing owners momentarily.
I mean, there's a lot of range. I mean, some people think they're helping. I read until I could not stomach it anymore, the whole radical economy thing. I mean, Glenn Will's idea of this harsh...
Oh, radical markets.
Arbiter, yes. Oh my God, that is such a horrific idea. I mean, such a horrific idea. And he means well, but it's the worst possible idea. It's like, I just want to tell him, it's like, okay, man, well, I guess your mom is also for sale. Okay. And how much is she? Because I want to buy her and her organs. You know,
absolutely.
It's like...
Yeah, I completely agree. It's super funny you mention it, because we'll probably have Glenn on to talk about radical markets. He and I have tangled about this before specifically. It's an interesting vision, right? And it comes out to the Ethereum and Web3 space in specific ways around like soul-bound tokens, what have you. But even those really have their extreme pitfalls.
I mean, I wrote an article in support of soul-bound tokens, and I hope your audience understands what I just referred to, because I don't think I
would. I think we ought to define it, Golda, if you could define it quick.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, we are kind of digressing from the things I really want to talk about a little bit. So I don't want to make this about, and I can't even probably pronounce it. They're going to make fun of me because I didn't pay enough attention to it to be able to pronounce this thing. It's like Harberger or Harshberger, his thing that he wants everyone to do, where everything's always for auction all the time. Basically, his idea is that people can stop evading property taxes if you force people to sell the stuff at whatever they just valued their property at. And that's just like such, I mean, it might stop people from evading property taxes. I'll give you that. But other than that, it's like such a bad idea because it essentially devalues any type of non-transferable value. It's like, I am going to let my tenant stay in this thing who's like my old elderly tenant stay in this property I own for only $300 a month because she's old. And so therefore I'm only going to be able to, you know, pay this much taxes on it. And I'm only going to value it at this much. And I'm not building apartment buildings here. And it's like, no, you can't do that. If you're doing that, somebody can buy you out and raise the rents on her. That's basically what that says. I mean, all that bad stuff that's going on to tenants now basically gives that the force of law that that has to happen, that it has to be the best use to the person with the most transferable liquid assets. It devalues any value that's not immediately transferable. And basically anything that is a long-term connection that is a value for another person is kind of by definition not a transferable value. It's not a liquid asset. There's different types of assets. They're not all scalars that can just be transferred. And I know, anyway, but I don't want to get into that kind of economic, and I could get in there, but I really want to talk about practical things we can do just, you know, to organically build democratic ownership.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was kind of the root of the conversation we wanted to tug on around your time at Uber and Postmates. And of course, you mentioned your team was great and all that. But in terms of worker empowerment and all, you know, Uber and other firms of that size over the past, in the last sort of, you know, Web2 wave of IPOs and new teams being founded, very much had a they're not monoliths, of course. There are some pockets of, you know, relative autonomy and accountability. Then there are others that are quite authoritarian. So now that you've sort of, you know, yourself been involved in Web3 and all that, what is the difference in the way that you work and the where you came from? Like, what are some of the major differences you've seen, positive and negative?
Engineers don't have a kick. I mean, engineers can switch jobs so easily, you know. That actually works pretty well to protect engineers, but it doesn't, it's much more, you know, authoritarian to the drivers who don't get a say on the algorithm of the app that's manipulating them. That's really where it comes in is, you know, a driver can't tell when he's going to take a call, which direction that call is going, whether it's going home or away from his home. I mean, maybe now they can, but at the time they couldn't tell that. And so a driver, you're going from, wants to go, just goes from San Francisco to Berkeley, wants to go back home to San Francisco, gets a call that takes them up to Sacramento because they can't tell ahead of time because that might mess up with the supply. And it's like this manipulation because we want this number of driver supply to go up. And yeah, I mean, sometimes that could just result in good rates for the drivers, but mostly it doesn't because the investors have this weird way of looking at it of like, oh, the fixed costs don't count. So the lawyer costs don't count, but the driver costs do. So we got to pay the lawyers a lot and squeeze the drivers. And it's just because of the way that that's being calculated. I'm not concerned with, you know, how engineers are treated. Engineers are engineers, and you can always talk and say, hey, that's a bad idea, because criticism is allowed in engineering world. That's the way it is.
Got it. No, that totally makes sense. And so a lot of the threads that run through what you're doing now really point at accountability and trust and using some of the things that are in Web3 technologies to sort of build new ways for people to organize and for them to sort of achieve these sort of outcomes with more agency, right? Like human, you mentioned, you know, having to have a way to have an impact on these things as a regular human being who isn't just like, well, I guess I'll read about it in the news. So maybe we kind of can get into that.
Yes,
now.
Thank you.
You can tell us a bit, because, you know, when you're out there building stuff at Uber and Postmates, of course, you're like, hey, this is a fun video game. Like you said, almost right. We have these adversaries. We got to stop these bad actors. But how can we actually create more agency using these new decentralized patterns of organizing in Web3? That'd be a great place to kick this off. So tell us about what's cooking. And that's not a metaphor. I'm not using an idiom. That's actually
what it is. The company. Thank you so much for redirecting me to that. So if anyone's still listening after all those digressions, I really appreciate it, because this is
talking about. Digressions are what we're all about here. Don't worry about it. It's where the interesting stuff emerges. So
great. So yeah. So what's cooking? And it's named that intentionally. Initially an event platform. We're also putting stuff under the umbrella now. We're kind of rebranding under cooperation.org. A friend of mine owned that domain, and it seemed like a good place to put things. So this grew out of a couple things. It was from like the whole society kind of fragmenting-ish and the wish to give people on a team more agency and more control. And in some ways, not to get back into digressions, it's a little bit always rooted in like the prisoner's dilemma. How do you help the cooperators win? And so it's a couple of those things. So we started What's Cooking, just myself and one partner here in Tucson, but we knew that we wanted to build community. And so very much from the start, we didn't have any money, but we knew we wanted everything to be work weighted. And that you know, you sometimes see this thing where partners in a, you know, will have an argument because like they're 50-50 and one guy's doing more work. And so from the very beginning, we actually used slicing pie, even when it was just two of us, because we knew that we were going to bring in more people. And Slicing Pie is an app that I found that matched something I thought I was going to have to write. I was like, oh, I'm going to have to write this thing that every time you do some work, you get a little bit bigger percentage. It's not a D-Web app.
Oh, yeah. Actually, before we get into the app, can you explain the concept, right? Because really what you said is you really wanted to find a way to bootstrap What's Cooking with equity, right? That's kind of the, and then right. You thought you'd have to write something that lets you do that, and then you just
yeah. Thank you for
so maybe you could thank you for backing me up
Jahed, because I will be terrible at that. I'm always just talking as if somebody already had everything, all the context that I have. So if we want, say the goal is that the people doing the work are kind of running the show, and the goal is to be able to move quickly, still make decisions quickly, still be very efficient, still be able to remove bad actors or people who aren't really, you know, doing correct work, but also, you know, avoid this problem of like kind of top-down control that even happens in nonprofits. Nonprofits have board of directors, and I always feel they have a problem with top-down control, to where you would have kind of a bottom-up accountability. And we didn't really plan out from the beginning exactly how to do it. This evolved kind of organically over time. But the goal was to build community and to be kind of worker-led in the sense of whoever's doing the work and putting in the effort and is in touch with the things on the ground would be in charge. But, you know, and have a way to take investment as well, and have something that could grow organically if it makes sense. So it's not something that an external person is deciding. And then the actual app itself at that time was specifically an events platform, essentially. You could say it was like a Eventbrite. Oh God, I can't get it. I'm going to tell you my elevator pitch in 10 seconds. But it was it's changed. But the original pitch, the original idea was getting together for dinner with your neighbors, and the idea of changing an intent into an event, changing search into a wish that could become granted by somebody, become an event. So we had the idea for this flow that could be used for home cooking and dinners together and activities together. And then that's definitely evolved over time. And we're now doing something that might seem a little bit distant from that, which is more involved with linked trust. But it had to evolve over time. And we still do have an event platform, actually, that's out there that people are using, that it's a little bit of Luma meets Eventbrite for Web3. But the idea basically of bringing together over their intents, that two people want to go to an event, two people want to do something. It's kind of like, hey, Jahed, let's go, you know, go catch this game. Anybody want to come? The idea that anything that two people are doing could become an event if it's opened up to their friends. And that the event is not, you know, the football game. I don't really watch football games, but it's the fact that you and I are going to is what makes it interesting to our friends. The idea of these micro events. So that was kind of the idea, was to have this micro event platform, but we wanted it to be owned by the people working on it. So I thought I was going to have to write something that would be able to share equity granularly. I feel doing it granularly and with peer review, I kind of knew that was important from the beginning, like having peer reviewed work be the thing that contributes to equity. And so, I looked around, of course, first to see what was out there. And it turned out there was something that was written. It's called Slicing Pie. And this is not a Web3 thing. It's just a way to share equity granularly, but it works really well. And we used that as the team grew, to where everybody could see how their slice of the pie was growing. And then the whole pie also grows. So it's just kind of a continuous way of distributing equity that kind of makes sense.
And like you said, it has a sort of peer review component, so that you're basically saying, hey, did, you know, X person do the thing they said they'd do, and do they deserve X amount of shares? Is that kind of how it works?
It's not so much X amount of shares. Well, I guess it is. I guess it is shares or slices, but the total number of shares grows. So instead of at the beginning, you're getting 12% of the company, and then you have to get the stock option grant for 12%. What happens is, you know, at first, maybe there's 100 slices and you have 50 slices and your partner has 50 slices. And then you do some work, maybe that's worth 10 slices. Well, now the pie has 110 slices and you have 60 and he has 50. So it's like the pie grows and your share is growing with it, depending on the work you do.
Got it. And that's an interesting dynamic. We had a previous guest on from Myco.space that's basically doing a inflationary dilutive DAO on-chain, where they're kind of helping people form LLCs in a similar way. So that where, you know, you have like a million shares and you bring some more people into the community, and the LLC is constantly having new shares form at a given rate or variable rate, that you can, their only job as an LLC of that community that owns its output, say it's a, you know, let's say it's an NFT group that produces a particular form of art that a lot of people like. Their only job really at the end of the day is to say, how do we distribute those shares? And then they make those decisions, however they make them. They might be to people who found a way to produce more of the art, to distribute it, what have you. That's their only job. So it's an interesting dynamic, I think, that points back to how you're doing it. So
that's interesting. I mean, and kudos to them for coming up with the thing. I definitely, though, did not want to have a company whose job was to decide how to distribute stuff. I want the work to me has to be like work that helps a person. Like, hey, you know, we wrote some code that then, you know, gets people together on events on Tuesdays. It, you know, here's our real, I really want it to be tied to real world events so that the value produced is getting people together in the real world, distributing food in the real world. You know, I really want that to be the value produced, though, you know, obviously, you know.
And I think at some point, you know, when we first met during the pandemic, I don't think we were ever going to have, we met over, I think, about a year ago. It was really unclear whether you're going to have a chance to do those kind of stuff again at the rate that would justify a platform like yours.
It was great for virtual events.
Yeah. Well, actually, that might be a good segue because Twitter Blue Sky is using your platform, right? Can you tell us a little bit of it about your engagement with them?
So I was in at the beginning of Blue Sky. I was very much involved with that community. And at the launch, Jay, who's the head of Blue Sky, asked me to help build the Blue Sky community at the beginning in order to hold that together. And so we were engaged by Jay to build that initial Blue Sky community. But however, we have transitioned it because the Blue Sky community, especially because of the very long time before the Blue Sky launch, became a big umbrella and a big tent that held a lot of different protocols. And now that the actual Blue Sky team has now formulated their very specific protocol, which is called ADX, Jay asked me to branch that community off, and it's now branded as DeSocial Commons. So now there's kind of a different meaning to it because it was such an umbrella, but she needed the brand of Blue Sky to mean the ADX protocol, which is the specific protocol that we're hoping that Twitter will adopt and will allow people to talk to Twitter users. So now Blue Sky just means that protocol. And the community I'm running is now DeSocial Commons, but it absolutely, you know, was supported as the Blue Sky community. And it has the SSB folks and the Fediverse folks and, you know, the Peergoss folks and everybody in that DeSocial Commons community.
Cool. Well, I think then if you back, I'm super interested even, you know, I think we sort of skipped over this, but I wanted to sort of make sure people understood that there's real users behind this platform, whether you get it or not, right? There's kind of, I mean, there's people. There's a whole bunch of people. So what I actually wanted to ask you was, how did you, you know, founding something like this, getting founding capital for it is very strange, right? Because people are like, what? You want to do what with shares and you want to slice whose pie, right? So maybe you could tell us a little bit about specifics around like where is it incorporated and legal structure and all that.
Yeah, I mean, when we started, I really, you know, didn't know much about this stuff and I wasn't necessarily going to do this in a Web3 way. I mean, I'm pretty much was more interested in the goals. And so we were actually a public benefit corporation, you know, incorporated in Delaware. We were incorporated in August of 2020. So it's pretty normal corporation. And basically, we would just informally track the shares until we had a safe, until we had investors. And luckily, we didn't have investors until we had a platform that works similarly, which is the Fairmint platform, which works very similarly to Slicing Pie, but is tokenized. And basically, with Fairmint, which we discovered along the way, you have a smart contract over future equity, which is a safe agreement, but it's tokenized. So when an investor invests in Fairmint, they're getting tokens, each of which is a contract over future equity, and the shares basically distribute very similarly to Slicing Pie. It's not exactly the same algorithm. There's a very specific algorithm for dilution and growth, but it works similarly. But one thing it lets you do is it actually lets you grant your team a certain amount of options in the same pool as investors. Now, there's a limit to that because you can't just completely dilute your investors' shares. So you have to have an agreement at the beginning that there's a certain, but instead of a tranche being cut out for your team sort of permanently, there's a tranche that's a non-dilutive tranche. Like maybe we've put 50% of our equity into the Fairmint platform, and half of that, so 25% of our total equity, is only for investors, and up to 25% of our equity is for our team. Now, as our pie grows, as there get more tokens investment, both of those shares grow. And the tokens are the same token. I just can't give more than that percentage of them to our team. But then when there's a secondary market, the team can start trading those. And I'm getting ahead of myself again.
Oh, well, actually, I just wanted to kind of pull you back to really, how did you finance this from the beginning, right? Because everyone who comes on the pod who has a sort of new, weird, in a good way, take on starting a company where they can more broadly distribute ownership and think through new incentive structures and stakeholder incentives kind of has a weird story where they go, well, I tried this on, it didn't work. And, you know, I'm a public benefit corporation in Delaware, but how do you bootstrap this? Did you self-fund it? So, was there personal debt? How did all that work?
Well, there's an advantage to not having money, which is that people will only do what you say if it makes sense. And I've seen this happen the other way with startups, where the guy who was running the startup had money and he was the one completely funding it. And he would be like, do this, guys. And we were like, damn, it's your money, dude. Okay.
I really love that. That is going to be definitely one of the sound bites we take out of this episode. It's like, there's an advantage to not having money. It's that people won't do what you tell them to do unless it makes sense. Amazing. I really just want to put that everywhere on Twitter. It's going to be the thing that invites people to listen to this episode. Love it.
Lovely. Yeah. I mean, to me, that's pretty fundamental. So essentially it forced me to get people to come work with us because we had to establish credibility by making sense, and value alignment, I think, were the two big things. And it turns out, because I'm a senior engineer, there's lots of junior engineers everywhere who just want to get, you know, skills and expertise. So it was actually really amazing. I mean, we had these people come who are these young, talented people from Egypt and Bangladesh, you know, who came to join our team for experience. And I would tell them straight out, because I had just been conned by a dude from a startup. And actually I realized how fast you could grow, because I had been conned by this dude who didn't have any money and who like conned everybody into working and lied to everyone, did all this stuff. And I was like, well, I'm not going to do that, but I also don't have any money. So I'll just tell people, hey, I don't have any money. You're going to earn equity here. I'm going to give you recommendations.
Love it. And so that is kind of what got you off the ground. So you said, hey, equity, we're going to freely share it. And then you started to look into the distribution mechanisms around Fairmint and Slice of Pie and slicing pie.
Well, I mean, we were using slicing pie from the beginning with my partner, because I knew that I didn't want to get stuck into something where we were going to argue over anything. And so we started using slicing pie like at the very beginning when there were like two of us. And but then as we, you know, decided, hey, we need someone to help with this, you know, I went to a boot camp and all these, what I want to get at is that we've really built a community, and it comes back around to that value of relationships, because I want to tell you that some of those people we had at the beginning, our human capital is like the most valuable we have. You know, we had somebody join us from a boot camp, Bonnie, who, you know, helped me write the initial app. You know, we get up at 5 a.m. We're both moms, you know, before our kids were doing stuff. And, you know, I almost never paid Bonnie any money. I mean, one time I did because she hosted this whole event for us, but she has a lot of equity. She doesn't actually necessarily need the money. It was something she wanted to learn. And she's just really, you know, gained a lot of skills. She's still very engaged. So we have a lot of these people who are just really engaged with us. You know, one of the very first developers was a young guy out of Egypt who came to us, Hemi, who was just learning stuff. But you could tell he was super smart. He got some skills. I think I might have recommended him to one of his first jobs in Web3, because a lot of people won't hire in Egypt, but this Swedish blockchain company did. And then Hemi is just like, super talented guy, you know, won a bunch of Google awards and has a lot of good startup jobs, teaches other guys and sends them all to us for training and comes back and like make sure that they're doing okay. And like, well, so the thing is, we have a community. We have these strong relationships with people who came early, not just because they have equity. Who knows if the equity is going to be worth something? It's really because of the relationships we have with them. But part of those relationships is the fact that they do have equity and the fact that we take that seriously, that everybody has some say. When we did first get some money, which I got, again, kind of through a relationship, through a referral, Rabble introduced me to Roy Bahad at Bloomberg Beta, who's one of the, I think he's the best investor, if you can get him, because he's extremely transparent, extremely open. I absolutely recommend him. And he was willing to invest in the Fairmint instrument, had his lawyers vet it. I think he probably spent more on the lawyers than he gave us, but that's okay. And, you know,
that's probably true.
And they said, basically, this is probably the best instrument out there that does this. They were impressed with it. And, you know, what that instrument does is it allows you to granularly share equity with both your team and with the investors in kind of this transparent way. And in addition to that, I know this is a digression and we're going to confuse people, but I want to just tease that you can also get token options that act like stock options. And I'll explain that in a little bit.
That's important. We definitely want to know more about that. Please jump right into it. Don't worry about, you know, getting into it later.
Okay. So anyway, so we did get this little bit of seed investment. You know, we got $50,000 from Bloomberg Beta. And at that time, we were just like, okay, team, how do we want to spend this? We all earned it. Let's have a meeting. Let's, you know, decide together how to spend it. Let's set the budgets. And let me tell you something, that people from Venezuela and Argentina are very frugal. And the team definitely wants to be frugal about those, you know, those investments. And I'm not saying that we spent it, you know, the best possible way. We didn't have experience. I would do things differently now. We should have done faster customer discovery. But we learned all that and we're bootstrapping on the next steps now.
Oh, wait. So other than that, actually, well, that's an important part not to gloss over, actually, I think. What were the mistakes you think you all made in those early days with how you allocated resources?
The classic founder mistake of like, this is a great idea I had and the world's going to love it. I mean, that's just the classic founder mistake of being a little too attached to our idea, not doing enough customer discovery and talking to enough things. I have the Talking to Humans book now next to my bed and I have to read it every time I don't talk to enough customers. I still absolutely love our first product and people are still using it. But if we'd done more rapid discovery earlier, I think, you know, we might have more quickly arrived at, okay, well, this might not be monetizable in the way that we think. We might not get organic growth in the way that we think, because actually people right. need a really compelling reason to do this. And we need to start with teams, not just assuming there'll be organic growth because we made this great mousetrap. And, you know, it was just absolutely the classic mistakes that you make if you are in love with your own product. And I was aware of those, but we still did them. So, you know, we still love our product and I still think it's a good product. And I think we're still using it and leveraging it, but just differently now in terms of mm-hmm. how we're doing our business strategy.
And it seems like through going through the product as you're building it over the course of the last couple of years through August 2020, you've learned quite a few things about coordination, about how to sort of weight governance versus equity and wealth building. There's a lot of things you folks have dug into and learned. So I think this would be a great time to segue into, you've got folks working in Afghanistan, Syria, Argentina, Venezuela, a whole bunch of people. What have you basically discovered in how to ensure a sort of global accountability for the people who are working on What's Cooking and another project you have, right? Because the problem is that we've seen, at least when you speak to other DAO operators and we speak to folks who are working in decentralized protocols, that folks either they come in and it's very binary in the early days, unless they have a lot of experience working this way, is they'll basically be, hey, we don't have any bosses. Let's just start doing stuff. And that, you know, weighs on everybody. The people who are used to working like that end up doing a lot of things. There's a nightmare, you know, chaos around like, what do we actually work on? And then hopefully they reach an inflection point where they say, hey, great, we might discover that other people have had these problems before. And they might find a resource or two out there, something like liberating structures or something like, you know, the tyranny of structurelessness and all the resources that link from it. But for you folks, there are a few things you've kind of noticed, right, which is you've talked about in the past. So maybe you can tell us, through working on What's Cooking, everything you've done there, how on the other side of it now, after a couple of years, what have you folks learned in terms of accountability and working in this sort of horizontal way of co-budgeting?
We never had that, like, what should we do issue, because we kind of had a goal originally and people would come on to work on that. And the people who would come on generally wanted direction. So it wasn't like that. We're like the kind of people who are joining a DAO to just be like, hey, I want to do my own thing. People were mostly joining to be aligned with our goal, to be part of a team, because that was kind of how we advertised, is like, be part of a team, learn more engineering, you know, learn what startup. So I would say, you know, I'm an engineer and I've worked at some places with some pretty good engineering practices and some with not so good. But a lot of times, you know, engineers are not fanatical, but very obsessive about fine-tuning our work. you know, fine tuning our tools. Why is Terraform so bad? I don't know. I mean, sorry, that was a total segue.
That's totally fine. I don't think, like I said, I don't think anyone from HashiCorp listens to the podcast. You're okay.
It's a wonderful tool and I might need your help one day. Anyway, but engineers are really obsessive about fine tuning our practices. So I really come into everything I do with trying to bring people best practices and norms right from the beginning. We spent a lot of investment in onboarding because I was essentially cognizant that a lot of the value I'm bringing to these junior people from around the world is not this token that may or may not be worth something. It's training them on how to be a good engineer and join a team. And so I wrote posts about it. We had an onboarding process. You know, we started right away with a task tracker in our Slack group. We were a pretty fairly disciplined team early on, I would say. You know, one of my co-founders who joined fairly early on, she used to run an 80-person team at Sigma. She's a distinguished engineer. She had very good engineering practices, very high-level person. So we were essentially trying to bring these, you know, good, solid engineering practices to our team. I mean, I wrote posts about how you ask questions, use channels. I mean, these are just, you know, the soft skills of engineering are really good ways to have, you know, less pain when you first start a normal team where, you know, the senior guys don't ignore you and make fun of your questions. I mean, they don't do that so much anymore. They're just different norms now. But anyway, I definitely have had my share of experiences, which I don't want to pass on directly.
Well, I think what was really interesting is that you correctly, I believe, in my opinion, have identified that that DAOs sort of conflate a lot of things with holding the token, right? But basically, yeah. There are other ways that you're thinking about this. Is basically that, you know, for instance, I think a lot of folks, this is an underappreciated point, but there are, if you look across DeFi right now, there are protocols like, Yearn Finance has been around for a couple years. It's essentially a yield optimizing vault that lets you basically say if you invest in a particular, you know, DeFi token pair, it'll basically find the optimal setting to maximize your yield. But the Yearn token itself shot up massively in value to something like $30,000 a token at its height. And at one point it was, I think, trading above Bitcoin. But the Yearn founders, since the beginning, since they first started, they said, guys, the governance token has no value. It's worthless. It doesn't let you do anything. I don't know what you're actually, you know, while a big hubbub. And so one of the things that I was very interested in kind of digging in with for you folks is that it seems like one of the learnings you've had is that you want to find a way to separate governance tokens from payment tokens. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's not hard at all, really, because that's what a safe agreement does. A safe agreement is a, you know, invest agreement over future equity that does not provide any governance until a liquidity event. And the interesting thing about a tokenized safe is that you don't really need a liquidity event because you already have a secondary market in the token. So you never are going to have that liquidity event if people start trading your tokens. So you essentially have for free decoupled your governance and your equity now. And so what we actually did, and I know people here are interested in the tokens and I haven't been talking about them. I think that, let me try to actually summarize a little bit better because I know I've been doing a ton of digressions. We do tokenized equity, but we don't have people who are really coming, you know, we don't have people coming who are just coming for those tokens and like coming for that quick, you know, short-term growth. We have people coming for, you know, the reasons of doing the work. And so that's why our culture is very work-focused. So we work kind of in a very traditional way, except that there is bottom-up accountability. So what we did is we put our equity into the Fairmint tranche. And the equity is there to be granted as tokens, both to investors who buy into us and to people who do work that's peer-reviewed and approved in our Taiga open source system. We can automate it right now. It's not automated. And then we also have a governance token, Team Cook, but we don't really use tokenized voting. What we did is we put into our bylaws that important things like electing the board of directors, which is something I talked to Uber about trying to get the drivers to elect a board of directors. That wasn't something they were interested in having a guy. We have a board of directors that is going to be elected, is term limited. I wanted to make sure they could kick me out. I think it's really important to be able to kick out the founder and the CEO, but only by the people doing the work. So I wanted to make sure that you can't have this, you know, permanent dictator. I don't never want to be a Mark Zuckerberg. We have in our bylaws that the work-weighted measurement, which is the work-weighted team cook token, has the ability to elect the board of directors. It has the ability to object to anything. And here's the crux of the thing. If anybody's still listening, you know, whatever, 47 minutes in, here's the crux. Here it is right here. You can actually just record this bit and you can have people save a lot of time. You want accountability. It doesn't mean that you need to vote on everything going forward. So what we call it is transparency, not permission. What we found is that to go fast, you do not want to make decisions with votes. And I already knew this, even from working in the Blue Sky community. I had that pain of, like, we tried to do like a proposal voting and realized the pain of trying to corral the votes of people who didn't even care and weren't even there. So you can make decisions quickly with a leader. But if that leader starts doing something stupid, up to 5% of the people can hold the vote, and then 50% of the people can say no and kick out the leader. So you have the accountability, and the leader can still go fast, but people could hold a vote to object. And there are meetings at any important point, which is major budgeting decisions, leadership changes. When we appointed a new CEO, we were like, hey guys, we need a work-weighted approval on the CEO. So when the new CEO came in, Sakshi, who was our new co-CEO, she wasn't just giving a talk of like, here's how it's going to be now. She was like, you guys have questions? Because I need your votes. You know, it wasn't like, I need your votes. It was more like, ask Sakshi some questions, guys. Because actually, working people, here's another real learning. The people who like to do work don't like to bother with talking and voting. So you need to be able to pull. That's why you need it to be work-weighted. You have to be giving the peer-reviewed way to your really core engineers. And then you have to pull them out to say, hey, guys, you guys who did all the work, come here. I want your opinion on this. You have to pull the opinions from the people who contributed work. And, you know, if people come and they're just kind of operators and they're just noisy, they need to get shut out. You don't need people who are just trying to game the system. We kind of actually, we've only pushed out a few people. But if I detected somebody seemed to be trying to game the system for themselves, I just kicked them out. I mean, that only happened to about three people because they didn't have any tokens at that point. They had just come in and I'm like, you're not the kind of person we want here. Sorry, bye. And it was basically, I want people who are interested in doing work, who put that first, who put the teamwork and the cooperation first, and then you have to pull their opinions. And so that's really the dynamic we're looking for. And it's quite different than the usual DAO Web3 dynamic. So it's really, we're not experiencing some of the same things that the DAOs experience, but, you know, we do have in our bylaws about the work-weighted voting. We do have, you know, we are assigning the team cook tokens. Honestly, not everyone on the team has got a wallet. We haven't prioritized making sure everyone has a wallet. So we do a lot of stuff with voice vote. And I did put into our bylaws that, you know, you could do it in an in-person meeting. You could do it by a certified email, or you could do it, you know, with a token vote. So I put three mechanisms of voting into the bylaws, not just one.
So as I understand it, effectively, the way that the voting works is, and correct me if I'm wrong, because there's a lot of great stuff in there, is effectively only five, there's a gating technique where you know, only need 5% approval, but then there's effectively a flagging technique where 50% of people can come together and by majority rule, vote to change a decision that's already been made. First of all, am I getting that right?
Yeah. And honestly, we've actually never used that mechanism. I mean, that actual mechanism.
Okay, so I have two questions based on what you just based on this, because this theoretical stuff I'm super interested in, these edge cases. So I'll ask both questions, and it both will probably go down a rabbit hole, but I'll ask them both because I think they're edge cases that are part of the same challenge. So the first one is, what happens when you have a leader that is a very good leader, but is making decisions that are unpopular and they just need time to play out? So that's the first question. And then the second question is, what do you think the limit of separating out the economics of a token from actual participation is in the aggregate?
Sure. And I think edge cases are important because I was a risk engineer. So in my mind, these are all risk scenarios where, like, my concern is, like, you know, there's two risks to a startup. The one is that you're going to fail, which is, of course, the obvious risk that most startups fall into. And the other is that you're going to succeed and that you're going to be taken over by bad actors, which is the other risk that most startups fall into if they do succeed, because when you get purchased, often they are not in line with your original values. So I was trying to basically write the bylaws to address the second risk factor, which is, if you succeed, how do you stop bad actors from taking over? So I was trying to put things in where basically everything's an attack vector. voting is an attack vector, but it's all an important mechanism. So I wanted to make sure that people, and so actually have some acceleration and velocity protections in there, which is not the question you just asked, where you can't suddenly assign yourself a bunch of tokens, that you can only assign them by a certain velocity. And actually the assignment of tokens has to be, there's a waiting period, but it has to be publicly published. Anybody could object to the assignment of the tokens, and then it goes through. So I'm really seeing that the tokens themselves as an attack vector, where a bunch of guys could just start peer reviewing each other's work and assigning each other tokens, and there has to be a stop to that. So that's one of the attack vectors I see. But what you really asked was not that. You know, again, in our experience, we have the opposite problem, because people we have are workers who tend to want to go along with the direction and are not tending to push back. So we haven't had that problem of having a direction, some time to play out. We haven't actually encountered that. I think what you find is that if you put it on people to have to object, to have to come together with 5% of people to say, hey, we want to hold a vote spontaneously without like a super like without having the voting be a blocking mechanism all the time, for people to take the initiative to come up with 5% of people and say, hey, we are raising a blocking vote, that's actually a really high bar. Initiative is actually a pretty high bar. I mean, it probably would happen with bad actors who are trying to do a takeover because they're motivated. And it would happen if people feel like you're cheating them. And it would happen if people are really upset. But if something's like the CEO is just making some, you know, decisions that might not be right, you're more likely to get people just talking about it in the cult if you have a culture of bringing up critique. And I pull critique at every meeting. I'm like, tell me what's wrong with this proposal, guys. Tell me why this won't work. So we have a culture of pulling critique. So I think you want a culture of bringing those things out and having those open discussions about, you know, why is this unpopular? What's wrong with this? Let's hear the critique. You have that culture, I think that helps. But yes, you could have 5% of the people say, hey, let's have a vote. And then if more than 50% of the people don't want that direction, no, the company's not going to go in that direction because those are the owners and they just told you not to do that. And so if the owners lose confidence in the CEO, yeah, they can tell the CEO not to do that. They can fire the CEO. And in this case, the owners in the sense of governance are all the people who have put work into the company over time. And I think that's fine. I think, you know, the CEO would have to defend, you know, their plan and say, hey, no, guys, give me some time. We need to convince people. And I think the need to convince the people who are doing the work is probably a positive thing, because people will tend to work better if they do buy in. So the CEO essentially has to get that buy-in from people, not like a fake buy-in, like you'd be fired anyway if you don't do what I say, but a real buy-in that like, here's the plan and here's why we're doing it. And they have to do that work to convince people to buy in.
Yeah. So the one problem I have with this, so like there's not, so, and it's not, it's, it really has less to do with kind of the structure that you put into place, but more kind of this scenario of majority rule that gets triggered. Cause this is a really interesting concept, is I worry about kind of the, and we're talking about firms here, we're talking about companies or organizations, however they're structured. But the scenario I think of is what you just described was Brexit, right? I mean, effectively you had the scenario that you just described, a campaign and then a referendum that led to an outcome that I think most people would say was not the best outcome for, and a lot of people that voted that way were influenced towards that outcome. So I think it's just something that I'm always thinking about in terms of this majority rule and in terms of leadership and how long it really takes to turn around. It's easier in an early stage startup because you normally have a charismatic leader that has recruited a bunch of people into an organization that have a shared mission and believe in that leader. Otherwise, there's no point in working in a startup because it's more painful than a lot of other places to work. It's really exciting, but it's also really hard work. But I think it's like, I wonder about the applicability in organizations that you're trying to turn around. And that could be a firm, it could be an NGO, it could be a DAO, it could be a country, where the decisions that a leader needs to take are unpopular. And effectively, these new voting mechanisms that don't give a leader a whole lot of time could lead to outcomes that don't support kind of what is the best scenario for the people that are voting themselves. So that's kind of one scenario, and I'll let you kind of back on that.
And then I definitely want to get to your other question as well. No, I think that's legitimate, and I think it's interesting that you use Brexit as an example. You know, I used to work for Steve Hilton, who was one of, I don't know if you know about the history of Brexit, but he was a fellow who used to work for David Cameron and then changed his mind and decided Brexit was a great idea. And now he's against sanctions on oligarchs. Hi, Steve. I troll him sometimes.
Perfect.
No, I love it. Love it.
They need their caviar.
Yeah, Steve will be pretty mad. But anyway, but no, I mean, the thing is, Brexit was a disinformation campaign. And disinformation campaigns work when you have voting by people who don't have, I mean, it's not that they don't have a stake in it. Everybody who lives in Britain had a stake. They didn't all put work into the stake. They were just kind of born there, right? And I think work-weighted voting is a little bit different in that you have a different kind of friction in that the people voting, you know, had to put effort into this. And so the people who worked at it the longest are going to have more shares to vote than the people who just came. So I think you're a little bit less subject to that kind of disinformation campaign, which actually I feel like, you know, you're going to have bad actors and other charismatic people come in. I don't think that people are just, you know, the people in England didn't just get up one day and decide, hey, let's all leave the EU, guys. Yeah, let's vote tomorrow and do it. I mean, this was a coordinated, well-funded disinformation campaign by an active bad actor, which is what we have trying to take over democracies right now. I mean, that's what we're up against.
Right. But that leads to the second question, right? Which is what happens when you divorce the economic portion of the tokenomics from the governance?
Well, I think work is economics. So it's not completely divorced. It's just, and actually in the future, I do want to actually amend, which will take 60%. I want to amend our bylaws later to give the investors, you know, some balance of powers. I really in favor of checks and balances. Actually, I read a lot of the stuff, you know, Jefferson and Madison wrote and things like that about, you know, and you know what? They were physicists, dudes. They were trying to model this on like Newton's laws. I mean, these guys took science seriously. And anyway, I don't want to get into all that, but I think that there should be checks and balances. And so you have to balance friction to stop bad actors. And it's just the same thing you have in risk all the time. You know, you have to balance the friction to stop bad actors against the, you know, convenience of moving forward quickly. And that's really what we're aiming at. So if you have work-weighted governance, that's not quite the same as one person, one vote governance. And I think it has a different type of friction behind it.
Right. I would agree. And I'm sorry to interrupt you because I really want to go on this point. But so I think work-weighted governance is different because there's a psychology of ownership that the person who worked in collaboration with others and put something into something is going to identify with the firm or organization that they're a part of. And what you would hope most citizens would as well. But we've seen that you know, that's not, there's a lot of heterogeneity in what kind of citizens think of in terms of a patriotism. So my question is if you tie work-weighted governance, right, but then you have a fungible token that's traded, how many people that earned those tokens based on work-weighted governance that can then sell those into other currencies, right, without a staking mechanism, without kind of the tokenomics tied to governance, you have the same attack vector, right? When you split out kind of the earning of the tokens from work-weighted governance from the actual governance itself, right? Am I missing something here?
Okay, so the equity tokens, which are the Cook tokens, are a contract over future equity, and those can be traded on a secondary market. And so, yes, the people who earned that equity can sell it and get money and do whatever they want with the money. The Team Cook governance tokens are not tradable. You could think of them like NFTs. They're, you know, they're non-transferable tokens. And yes, they continue to have governance even if they sell their equity. And we thought about, we're not doing a decay mechanism on the governance, but as we continue to issue governance tokens to new people and as the team expands, you know, it naturally dilutes the original tokens. And because asking them to approve every measure, and we're not asking them to vote on every measure, and they only have this ability to object, they're not necessarily directing the funds all the time. They're not like, oh, hey, I want to take $1 million and give it to my brother. They can't really necessarily do that without going through a normal mechanism of, you know, convincing the CEO and the people running the company that, hey, we should spend $1 million on this. They can't really just make a proposal and take the money. That's not how it works. We actually just run pretty much like a normal company. And our idea is to only get to about 250 people and then spin off a child company. Because I think 250 is a very healthy size for a company. And because of the equity, you could actually own a stake in the child company in terms of you could own an equity stake in the child company, but not necessarily a governance stake. And so you could have a lot of related companies. I think of it like mammals or dinosaurs. But right now we have these giant corporations with tiny little peanut brains trying to eat everybody up. And I would like to switch to a mammal type operation where these little companies can communicate with each other and have shared DNA and shared values and quickly reproduce and spin off new little companies. I would like to see that model propagate more. So I don't plan to get to 10,000 people on the governance thing. And also 250 happens to be the limit before you have to do a different kind of filing with the IRS in terms of equity shared. So it makes a convenient limit. So I'm not quite sure, and I want to talk about this vulnerability. This might be really important. I want to point out also there's certain types of objection votes that take 60% of people. So I tried to put a little bit of friction in there. And we could, and we do have actually a board of directors. And I think I basically was trying to put a little bit of balance of powers and checks and balances without creating new attack vectors was what I was aiming at. So, for example, it takes 60% to amend the bylaws and the approval of the board of directors. So it's hard to amend the bylaws, but it can be done.
Yeah, I think you're not going to face problems anytime soon, right? You may never face problems, but I worry about the limit here as the space grows. Because I think what happens with this, and look, I think the bifurcation of token of kind of incentive tokens tied to work or discrete events from governance tokens is important and is a natural evolution of the field. But I worry that the limit here in 5 to 10 years is a similar thing that you have around proxy voting with shares, where you have a few big firms that own the vast majority of proxy votes because of ETF allocations. And you could get into a situation, we don't live in a world where DAOs and cooperatives have hostile takeovers, right? But the natural evolution is these firms are going to grow. And to the extent that there's a decoupling of the people that get kind of an economic incentive from those that can vote, you have this attack vector. And the attack vector, it might only be, you know, a 5% allocation to the workers that have tokens, right? But then the investors might have 50% allocation of the governance tokens or 45% allocation.
We actually don't, like, this is a safe agreement. So currently the investors don't get any governance tokens.
I totally agree. Yeah. Like, I totally agree. I'm not so much thinking of this. I totally understand where you are today. Mm-hmm. I'm more thinking of it in terms of, because this is a design is a, I think, important evolution in the design of organizations, but mm-hmm. in the limit of this design, okay. as all these organizations scale, I worry 5 to 10 years from now that what you have is effectively these proxy organizations that have amassed a lot of capital that go in and buy up a lot of these and then have an attack vector into a lot
of them. Is it clear, and I know that I kind of jumped around here, is it clear that you cannot buy governance tokens? There is no way to buy a governance token.
Like today, right? And they're like, if that's always the case, sure. Right. Like that makes sense.
I think the model I'm proposing is a model in which you can never buy governance. You don't buy governance. You might.
Gotcha. It's work. This is the work weighted governance only.
Yeah, this is work weighted. Governance tokens are non-transferable and you can only earn them by doing work. Now, I think as we go forward, we get more investors and as they start asking for this, we might want to give them some type of ability to object and some type of, you know, checks and balances governance. I think investors have a role definitely, but essentially what we're saying is it's like this in some way similar, like the New York Times does this where they separate their equity and governance. You know, your investor is investing that this company, they're getting a guaranteed over future equity event. If this company's ever sold, they are going to get that percentage and they're going to have preferred, you know, shares over that exit event or over that liquidity event. So if this company's ever sold, they get that. And that's what they're betting on, essentially. They're betting on the value of this company. They're betting on the leadership team. They don't get to direct the leadership team. They're betting on the leadership team. So if you buy into the equity, you're betting that this little company is going to do well, but you don't get to tell it what to do. If you don't like it, take your money out. That's how markets work. You know, sell your tokens. That's fine. Buy your tokens or sell your tokens. That's what you get to do as an investor. You don't get to tell the company what to do. You just get to bet on its direction. The only people who get to act it are the people who put in the work and who had peer-reviewed, approved work that went into the company that grew over time.
Yeah, so it sounds very similar to cooperative law, right? In the US and Canada in particular, where you have essentially in these worker cooperatives, and I get the distinction between the you know, allocating the allocation of the tokenomics and the governance, but it moves more towards kind of a one member, one vote model without that kind of linearity because there's no transferability, which I think is really interesting. If you look at like, so we've had kind of cooperatives on, we had Savvy on, we'll have Stocksy on, digital cooperatives, and they're very good about participation in governance. And this non-transferability is really smart. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have something like Braintrust, right? Which is a skilled labor platform. And if you look at their allocation of their rewards over the first 12 months, the token holders today, there's about 3,500 token holders, but the allocation of who is in the token holders today versus who sold those just after completing discrete events that got them that token allocation, whether it was inviting people to the network or inviting people that were hiring talent from the network, there's the vast majority of people sold the tokens. So they earned the tokens, they sold it, they don't want to participate in governance, exactly what you're saying. So I think there's benefits around each model. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but it's definitely clear to me how this has been structured. I'm just kind of thinking, you know, 5 to 10 years ahead, as more and more organizations like yours, and maybe more and more organizations that don't have as strict models for you, the only way you participate in governance is through work, could lead to this scenario where you actually have fairly large proxy voting firms and the concerns around that.
No, I mean, I think anytime that you sell governance, it's a problem. I mean, look what happens in the U.S. Senate. I mean, this just doesn't work really well. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think like what you pointed out too is like, and what Martin's getting at as well is that, and I think this is absolutely spot on. So it's interesting to see how you solve it is that, you know, a lot of folks, some of them have come on the pod even have been like, yeah, the one token, one vote thing is really not working out for us. And it's not that like we couldn't, like you were able to look ahead and say, yeah, that doesn't work. Let's try out a solution. Right. And there are many other solutions in that space. And so that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think what it is, and I like the values behind cooperatives. I do not want to belong to a cooperative because I've been working on this for 2 years. I put a lot of work into it. There is no way that I want an equal vote for me and a guy who just walked in off the street. No, I am. And, you know, I have a lot more shares because I put a lot more work in. And, you know, yeah, it's not going to be the same. And also in cooperatives, you get this problem of the talkers. You get people who just come in and they talk and they talk and they want to get consensus. And like, you know, shut up, we're working. You know, I'm sorry. I mean, cooperatives are lovely. I'm good friends with
Nathan. That is the pod. That is the podcast. 5 seconds right there.
Shut up, I'm working. No, and honestly, I think it's spot on. Like, I hope all my cooperative friends don't come after me for this, but I think this just harkens back to a great point that you made about how you want to pull work from people and how the people who have come in and understand the mission just want to do the things and they start going in the direction you pull the work from them, and you don't have to say, so here are 4 proposals for this quarter. Cause shit, and you know, even when you look at normal companies, right, when they get to a certain size, OKRs become overbearing, like strategic planning for every quarter for the year is just it's a huge problem. And then like even breaking it down by division, department ends up being a problem. So I really, really, really think this is a super cool, innovative way to say, hey, the people who are going to put in the work earn the ability to govern. And also we're going to just say, here's what we're doing. Let's have a few meetings to start figuring out how that goes. But we don't need to have consensus. We want to work on things. That makes a ton of sense.
Right. And the thing is, it's just, you get a very different kind of people. I mean, workers, they just want to work and they're only going to really critique things. I mean, you know, my best guy, who's my back-end guy, you know, he's just one of these lovely, humble developers who's like, you know, he'll be like, I don't understand this. And what he means is like, what you're saying doesn't make any sense, but like, he'll say it in a nice way, but he's like, you know, tell me again why we're doing this. Tell me again how this works. Tell me again. And, you know, those are the people you want really running your system, are those quiet, humble people who are just going to ask questions to make things make sense and are going to like, and we do this a lot where like we go around, we'll have a meeting and we're small enough and we have a meeting, we always make sure everyone gets heard and we pull objections from everyone. That's just like such a strong culture in us. I keep repeating that, but I think there's a couple principles here. You cannot buy governance. If you can buy governance, you're not this kind of animal. And I'm sorry, yes, you have vulnerabilities I can't address, because you can buy governance. Whatever you do, if you have value, somebody's going to buy your governance and you are going to be body snatched. Corporations get body snatched all the time. You know, if you can buy governance, as soon as you have value, somebody is going to be a vulture and eat it. So don't buy governance. That's all I can tell you. Do not allow people to buy governance. So we have the frictions, what we have, you know, normal engineering processes for making decisions, you know, just best practices in terms of customer discovery, stay at a reasonable size that you can actually be agile. When you get bigger, have a child, you know, spin off to another company and have another small company that's about 250 people moving forward. And, you know, you have to be rigorous and test yourselves against, you know, the real value you're producing to people on the ground and having customers. And once you know, we have a larger customer base. I would also like to have checks and balances with that larger customer base. Right now, we do not have a huge, you know, public community. We have a couple thousand users and, you know, maybe 100 active users. So it's not like a super big community. We do have some business to business contracts and the Link Trust model, because we're also doing stuff with Link Trust and verifiable credentials that are third party and uncertain verifiable credentials that we could get into. So we're getting into some business to business models. I do think, though, that if you have a large community of public users, that those should also have some say along with the investors in a checks and balances model.
I think you are. I don't think so. I think you made a great summary of everything we've covered and how we ended up here. So I think this is a good spot for us to sort of head towards the exit. And I think we always like to sort of pause and say, give you a minute to make sure that you let everyone know what you're working on, where to find you, how to get involved in the project. So please let us know.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. Like I said, just think of the prisoner's dilemma or the cooperator. So cooperation.org is kind of the umbrella that everything is under. We have evolved from an event platform. We're now actually doing linked trust using signed certified credentials for trust, open trust claims, and we're applying that to the consumer world for worker reputation. We're doing a contract with Human Protocol. We're going to do some open source work. We're going to be at Rebooting the Web of Trust. We're just at DWeb Camp. And so definitely, if you want to talk about anything in trust or cooperation, we're your guys, and we're trying to do a very, you know, open protocol around that that has a lot of applications. So thank you very much for that chance to boost our stuff.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining. And that's What's Cooking. That's cooperation.org. And there are in the show notes, we have listed, we'll be listing everything from the Fairmint piece that was about you guys, the slicing pie and everything. So thanks a lot, Golda, for your time. This was awesome.
Thanks, Golda.